We do have frequent conversations about wildlife on the exchange. We'll have another one today, but without an actual wildlife biologist. Instead of science, we'll enter the realm of myth and mystery with storyteller Thomas Doty as our guide. He takes his longstanding oral work and translates it to the printed page in a new book called Doty Meets Coyote. It's published by Blackstone and Ashland as part of its Legacy of a First Nation series. Takelma Elder Agnes Baker Pilgrim, Tao Waihui, joined us previously. Tom Doty is a native Southern Oregonian with roots in the Shasta and Takelma tribes, as well as in Ireland and England. He grew up hearing stories from and about relatives who called this region home for generations. He can often be found in front of another crowd sharing those stories to another generation. Tom Doty, pleasure to have you on the Jefferson Exchange. Been a long time.
Thank you so much, Jeff. Honored to be here.
Was there a time in your life when you knew you would be a storyteller yourself?
Well, there was a time in my life I knew I was going to be a writer. Back in the sixth grade, I had a math teacher who seated us in a classroom according to what grade we got on the last test. So A row, B row, C row, D row, F row, right? Always in one of the last two rows. But that same year, I had a wonderful writing teacher, and she took me aside one day. She said, "Tommy, you do pretty well with words, right? You know," and she said, "I bet if you worked harder on your writing and got better, it would matter to you less which row you sat in math, you know." And that year, I decided to be a writer. But, you know, I also became, and I write about this in the book a little bit, I became a listener and a watcher of things. So I was the kid always out on the playground, standing back from the crowd, listening, watching, taking it all in, the sounds, the crying, the laughter, the way things looked. And then eventually, you know, I went off to study writing here at SOU and up at Reed College, and then spent some time with the Tlingit Indians in Alaska. And I came back home, you know, and nobody was keeping alive our traditional stories in this area. And so I decided that would be me. And when I told this was 1981, when I told my 90-year-old grandpa I was going to be a storyteller, he says, "Well, that's good. You never were very good at math." You
know? Boy, everybody knew your math reputation.
Yeah. And he said, "Just make sure you know how to figure so you don't get done over." You know, at first I thought he meant, you know, charge enough money, you know, uh-huh, to tell stories. But of course, as I dove into the stories and discovered how deeply they affect us and how they can heal and all the power of storytelling, I realized he meant much more than that. And so that was kind of my beginnings in stories.
So you're beginning telling them, but I mean, there were other storytellers in your youth who apparently were really good at the craft themselves.
Yeah, well, I heard a lot of stories from my grandmother, Grandma Maud. She was kind of the family storyteller, and she'd gather his kids around and tell us stories. And some of those stories were from our native ancestors. Some were from our Irish and English ancestors, and stories about, you know, settling in the Rogue Valley as well. You know, even the Irish part of my family was settled out in Sam's Valley by the 1800s, late 1800s. And so those stories had a big effect on me too. And, you know, Grandma Maud was kind of she was a large woman, didn't really move around very much, but she had this incredible voice, and she had different voices for characters and animals and the stories. And her hands would, invite us into the room. And the stories really, really, and I mentioned this in the book, really became our good friends. And she died when I was 9 years old, so I was pretty young. But her voice, hearing those stories, and then as I grew up hearing other stories, we were a very outdoor family around the campfire outside, a lot telling stories. You know, I've never forgotten those voices, those stories, and they've stayed with me forever.
It always seems like there's a connection between something burning and stories. I mean, it always helps to have people seated around something warm.
Yes, the fire, the hearth, the whole idea of that. You know, it's interesting. I was thinking about this just the other day and talking with an actor friend of mine, and how as a storyteller and an actor, we approach light very differently. As an actor, you're on stage. As long as you got your blocking right, the light will show up. Uh-huh. There's somebody there taking care of that. But as a storyteller, you have kind of a fixed source of light, whether it's a moving light like a candle or a fire, or whether it's stage lights. I'll go into a theater, and the lighting guy will say, "Well, how do you want the lights? Just sort of, you know, kind of across the board, kind of straight across the board like that." I said, "No, make it kind of splotchy, like put some shadows over there, bright lights over there, right?" And then as I tell the story, I move in and out of the light as the story dictates. So if I want a little shadow on my face, I can feel the light, you mm-hmm. know? And it's the same thing with firelight, right? But fire, you know, is always the center of the hearth in the house for centuries. And that's where people gathered not only to get warm, but to get warm in a different way and listen to the stories.
I noted you mentioned traveling up to Alaska, hanging out with the Tlingit folks, and I noticed also you traveled to England and Ireland as well. Were you looking for roots? Were you looking for stories? Or?
A little bit of everything. I was young. I was looking for anything that would make sense to me, really. And in England and Ireland, I was very interested in the stories of King Arthur. And so in England, I went from one King Arthur site to the next. And in Ireland, it was the Irish poet W.B. Yeats. Yeats was really a model for my work, and I really realized that as I got into storytelling. So when I got to Ireland, I threw away the Michelin Guide to Ireland and picked up a copy of the collected poems, and then just went from one poem to the next. And then up in Alaska, Southeast Alaska, I'd gone up to visit relatives and kind of fell in with the Tlingits, spent a lot longer than I thought I would. Went to the dances and what were passing as potlatches back then, and of course storytellings, and learned a lot about what it means to be native and the native way of looking at the world and living in the world. And it wasn't too long after that I came back home and decided to be a storyteller.
Was there an adult who was a good guide for your entry into story? I mean, when you were an adult, I mean, you obviously mm-hmm. had great examples as kids, but was there somebody who was a good mentor to you as a storyteller in your adult years?
Several, actually. You know, when I started storytelling, there were no classes in storytelling, no work. You can get a degree now at a college in storytelling, right? But not back then. So I did what storytellers before me have done for thousands of years. I sought out the elders, and I learned how to listen, which was a big challenge for me. Listen to what they had to say. Listen to the stories. And some of those elders included Chuck Jackson, who was the first tribal chair of the Cow Creeks after the Cow Creeks got their status back. C. George or Caraway George down in Hornbrook, Shasta. He was major in that. And then once I met Aggie, that was early on in my career.
Agnes so Baker was, Pilgrim, Talwaiwi.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, that was in the early 80s. You know, she became a very good friend. So, yeah, there are many, many of the Native elders who would share things with me, and I would sit and I would listen. It went way back to being in the sixth grade when I decided to become a listener and a watcher of things. You know, that served me really well for years because you can't tell a story until you know how to listen.
A whole bunch of Tom Doty stories in one book in Doty Meets Coyote. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange and talk more with him, and you can join us as well. Back on the Exchange with Tom Doty and you in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the longtime Southern Oregon storyteller, Thomas Doty. He's put a lot of his oral tradition into written form in a book called Doty Meets Coyote, put out by Blackstone Publishing in Ashland. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we explore some of the stories that Tom has come to know over the years and come to tell very well. 800-838-3760 is our phone number. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. I was asking about your travels. I love the story about throwing out the Michelin guidebook, just going with the poems of William Butler Yeats. But some of the roots, obviously, right here. I mean, tell us about the village of Coyote's Paw.
Oh, Coyote's Paw. It's an old village that was lived in continuously for at least 7,000 years, along the Klamath River, just over the border from Oregon. And way back when I was beginning storytelling, Caraway George, a Shasta elder, decided to take me up there one day. And so we hopped in his bright purple dune buggy and went up the old Edgar Beswick Road, right? And he brought me to this amazing village site. And of course, it was abandoned in the 1870s. But in that village site, the dance ring is still intact. The cairns that are the graves of the ancestors are still there. The old Indian trail that once ran the entire length of the Klamath from Upper Klamath Lake to Requa, the mouth of the Klamath, is still intact in the village. There are walls, rock walls, separating the cemetery from the housing area. You can see the depressions of the houses, the outline of the sweat lodge. You can see the larger depression where the community house was, where the dances and the storytellings on the winter nights. The ghost dance trees from the 1870s are still standing, all five of them. It was an amazing place, one of the very few sites I've been to, and I've been to a lot. where you can walk in, and just because of all the rock stuff still around, you can really get a sense of the layout of a traditional village. And I was wondering, why is this fellow bringing me to this very vulnerable site? You know, if I'd taken up the job as a pot digger, it would have a whole different kind of thing, right? And then I realized that this was where my people were, you know, and he started telling me stories about that, and that there was a tribal memory of my ancestors living in this village, and everything began to make sense, you know. But, Coyote's Paw and Tillamook, you know, on the Rogue River, where we do our salmon ceremony each year, where Aggie and Steve Kiesling and I brought the salmon ceremony back to the river in 2007.
That's present-day Gold Hill?
Yes, right near Gold Hill. I remember going out there with my grandfather going fishing, you know, not knowing at the time, of course, that it was an extremely old native site.
It must have been interesting, though, straddling those two worlds, though, with
yes.
the English-Irish part of you and the Native American part of you, and one part somewhat ignorant of the other.
Well, where they come together for me is what it means to be Native. And, you know, Native American is one thing. You know, it has to do with family and particular roots and genealogy and a particular tribe. And that's really important to keep all of that together, to pass along the traditions through those connections. But anybody can be Native to a place. And being Native means that you have a sense of belonging to a place. You have a stake in it, that you participate in the landscape rather than intrude upon it. It means that you know the stories. And because you know the stories, you have a sense of caring or a sense of caretaking the place. And it means that when you're driving down Interstate 5 past the Table Rocks, you know that they're much more than ancient remnants of lava flows. You know that they're the Dragonfly brothers, the Daldal brothers, who came up the river to make the world ready for the arrival of the human people and the myths, and that's where they made their home, the two Table Rocks, the two Dragonflies that became the center of the Takelma universe, the ribs of the great animal that is the world, with a head, big, fat round head being Crater Lake, and the neck, Gwin Takabak Danda being the where the Rogue River begins up at Boundary Springs, the ribs being the center of the animal, and the rear end, and please excuse me folks there on the coast, is Gold Beach. And the lifeblood of that animal is Galam, the Rogue River, right? And so it's this great animal. That's how we see the world, but it's also a symbol for our lives. Up at Boundary Springs, the river just gushes out of the side of the hill, right? Five springs, boom, it's a full-blown river. It's ripping down through the canyons like childhood, like birth, childhood, out of control. Rogue River Gorge, Takelma Gorge. When it comes down to the middle part of the river, it slows down, sometimes fast, sometimes slow, like our middle lives, past the Table Rocks, the ribs of the animal. And then as it flows toward its death, you know, down there at the beach where it flows into the river, it kind of widens out, like some of us widen out a little bit, right? and then it flows into the Pacific. But that's not the end of the cycle, because out over the Pacific, the clouds form, come back over the Cascade Mountains, bring the rain, bring the snow that feed the springs, that feed the river, that keeps the cycle going. And so it's a long answer to a very easy question, but to be Native is to realize that you belong in this place like this. It's knowing that when you go hang out at a very special place, it's maybe just special to you, but maybe it's also a special place for Native people, or maybe it's a place where the stories come from, that you hang out there long enough, you discover that the landscape has a language and a story to tell, and now you're part of that because you're there listening to it and you're becoming part of that world. And that really is what it means to be Native. And so when I decided to become a storyteller, I mentioned that Yeats was a model, because our stories from here, our traditional stories, they were just, they were blasted to pieces. The whole culture was in the 1850s.
Because of the uprooting of the natives.
Oh, yeah,
The reservations.
Culture was sent to the four winds. So it's been part of my work as being kind of a mythological detective, right, to go around and find the pieces and put them back together. And that means looking through 1,500 pages of handwritten field notes from the 30s. It means listening to the elders. It means visiting these places. It means poking around the back rooms of museums and people's attics and visiting libraries and all kinds of places. You, bit by bit, you piece it together. That's what this book is all about. But I realized that Yeats was a model because this incredible Irish poet through his poetry, his plays, the founding of the Abbey Theater, through his collections of folklore, you know, his work with Lady Gregory to bring all that folklore back. He really, really helped to bring the Irish mythology back to the Irish people. So his work became a model for my life's work, bringing the stories back to the people and making them really available to everyone, to people who are Native American and celebrate that, to people who feel native to this place and maybe don't have the Native American lineage, and simply to people who are hearing the stories for the very first time. You know, they're everybody's stories. They belong here as we live here.
I find myself thinking of these as stories that are as old as people, as old as humans. I mean, they do go back millennia, don't they?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And excuse me. And in our stories, we think of everybody as people. You know, there are the human people, of course, but there are also the bird people and the salmon people, who we call the swimmers affectionately, or the what Aggie likes to call the one-leggeds, the tree people, right? And the oldest people around are the rock people. And they're the oldest ones, and they're the first storytellers. And so it's not unusual or strange to see the rock writings, you know, the pictographs and the petroglyphs on the rocks as being, you know, the stories that the rock people tell, some of the oldest stories, right?
Tom, grab your headphones. We're going to invite people to call in, and we're going to talk to Tom Doty here on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is called Doty Meets Coyote. He's been a storyteller and quite a bit of renown around Southern Oregon for many years now. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760. That's our phone number. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Elliot in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Tom Doty.
Hey, good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
Tom, I'm wondering if you have information about both the Roundup in the early 1850s and Salt Cave itself.
Salt Caves on the Klamath River?
Right.
On the Klamath River.
Okay. Thanks for that, Elliot.
Well, the Roundup, and I assume you're referring to the removal of Native people from here, happened in 1856 at the end of the Rogue River War. And there were actually five trails of tears that left here that spring to remove the Native people to the reservations up north. And, you know, it was some were forced marched, some were put on the steamship Columbia and shipped up the coast. A lot of Native people died on that from exposure to elements, and many others died of sadness. You know, imagine that, dying of sadness because you're being, you know, you're being forced from your homeland where you've lived for thousands of years. And of course, when they got to the reservations, food was scarce, housing was practically non-existent. They were forced to cut their hair to look like white people, to wear white people's clothing, and they were told that if they spoke their language or told their stories, that they would be punished severely. You know, and if anything good came out of that, it's that late at night on the reservations, the people would gather, the Native people in the shadows, and with very quiet voices and with gestures that were so small it was hard to see them, they would whisper the stories to each other night after night after night, because they realized how important it was that the stories at least stay alive. And a lot of those stories got passed along to us from, like, Grandma Aggie's great-aunt, Frances Johnson, Gwisquishon, Chipmunk Face, who told a lot of those stories to the anthropologists. As far as Salt Caves, there was, of course, the big controversy years ago to build a dam.
A dam.
There,
mm-hmm.
Right.
That's interesting. We've gone from adding a dam to the Klamath River to taking four out.
Salt Caves is just a little bit upriver from my ancestral village of Coyote's Paw. I don't know a lot about it. I haven't visited Salt Caves, but what I have heard is that it is a very spiritual place that traditional medicine people do healing ceremonies at. And I'm not really in a position to know a lot about that because it's not really my thing. But all I know is it's still continually used. It's still an active Native site and very, very special to the Shasta people.
I find it really interesting that the village that you can point some lineage back to is called Coyote's Paw with the connection to Coyote here. So give us the Coyote character sketch. I mean, he's quite the trickster in Native tradition.
He is. Coyote has what he likes to call his magical bag of masks. And many of those, of course, he will claim are masks that he puts on to become other characters, because he claims he's all the characters in the stories, right? We have different personas also of Coyote himself in the various stories. So sometimes he's Coyote Old Man, and sometimes he's just Coyote. Sometimes he's kind of plays a detective role, sleuthhound Coyote, right? Or there's a story where he and I are transported time traveling back into the Wild West, and this is down at Del Rio Vineyards down there at Rock Point, and we get off the stagecoach, and Coyote's got his cowboy hat on with his ears poking out through the hat, you know, and really ready to poke a few cows, he says. But he's a true trickster character in the sense that he has a split personality. So a true trickster has to be part wise man, part buffoon, or part creator, part fool, you know, however you want to define it. And so it's
crazy like a fox, in a sense.
Yeah, exactly. And a fox, you know, is one of the trickster characters as well. So the fool part is the part that's breaking all the rules, causing trouble, you know, getting himself into trouble, always having an agenda to further his own agenda, right? Always a plan that never works out, right? And always getting, you know, messed up into pieces. He's always got to put himself back together to be in the next story, right? But a true trickster isn't a true trickster unless, despite all of that, you know, he always brings something important to the people. That's the creator part, right? So Coyote brings us Crater Lake. He brings us good sex. He brings us tobacco, even if he doesn't intend to, right? Uh-huh. He brings these things. So Wile E. Coyote, Saturday morning cartoons, not a true trickster. He's just got the fool half time after time after time. And as Coyote likes to say, you know, who would teach the people what to not to do by doing it? You know, that's what he does.
Don't do what I do yet.
Yeah, right. Exactly. You got it.
So I love the tale of the animals deciding who'd be the son, and Coyote mm-hmm. kind of flunks out of this, but in spectacular fashion, as I think is Coyote's
right.
want.
Right. That is one of my favorite stories, and that's a story I heard originally from my grandmother, and it's a story that's also got many, many variations up and down the coast. One thing I love about this story is it really puts out the importance of stories, because here we have sunlight coming into the world, what we need to live, sunlight. And stories, what we need to make our lives worthwhile, coming into the world at the same time, right? So stories and sunlight having that equal presence in Native culture, you know, and it just goes to show just how important the stories are.
Let's take another call. Here's Pam and Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with renowned storyteller Thomas Doty. Pam?
Hi. I was teaching third and fourth grade in Ashland. And I don't know if Tom remembers this, but he very graciously met my classroom while he was on his way north for another appointment, and walked the trail to Boundary Springs. And during that year, we were studying water, riparian, water insects, salmon. I used to raise the salmon eggs to release them in the waters. And he walked the trail with us to the head of Boundary Springs, where the Rogue River begins.
I remember that well, Pam. That was an incredible, incredible walk. You know, that was amazing. Yeah.
Any
wonderful stories. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks for that, Pam. Appreciate that. So you are pretty much, when a hat drops, you can tell a story.
Pretty much. Yeah. Or I can show up, or, you know, yeah, at the right place, the right time. Yeah.
Is Coyote always with you, in a sense?
Yeah, I'd say so. We have these conversations in my head all the time. At least I guess that's what other people tell me, is that they're in my head. But Coyote is he's very handy at times. You know, I can blame a lot of things on him.
Coyote did that.
But, you know, he's also very good, and this comes out in the stories in this book on several occasions, of pushing me to the edge, of challenging me, making me take that extra step, like in the Truth of Trees story, saying, hey, are you just going to hang out here in the old growth and be comfortable, or are you going to walk into the clear cut and face the monster? You know? And so he's always good for that too, giving me that little extra nudge and then standing back and see what happens.
So Coyote's not always a good influence necessarily, but he's certainly always going to require you to test yourself, it
yes.
sounds like. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, you know, we talked earlier about the animal people, And, you know, the reason that all of the people are people is that we are all related. And how it works in the stories is Coyote is only part animal in the stories. He has a lot of characteristics of Coyote the animal. But what makes him endearing to us for so long, for thousands of years, is that he is very human as well, and he does human things. He does stuff we can relate to. We laugh at him. He does all the stuff, like we said, that we can't do, right? So he's, in that sense, he's as human as anybody else.
It seems like in the Native American story tradition, there's lots of personification or transformation of animals with human traits, like Coyote, people turning into mountains, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, again, it comes back to everybody as people,
yeah.
And so when you look at a mountain like Mount McLaughlin, Willamka is the name, means the floating mountain. That there's a story about the mountain floating around till it finds its place, you know, up there in the Cascades. But it's also the home of Acorn Woman, who comes down from the mountain every year to spread her skin across the oak trees to bring acorns, which was an amazing food for the traditional people. But it's not just her home. She really is part of the mountain, because in the winter when she goes back up, you start to see her long white hair in the shape of the snow on the mountain, mm-hmm. right? And as that snow disappears in the spring, you know she's headed down the mountain. So calling a place home just doesn't mean you live there. It means you're really a part of that place.
Mm-hmm. Is less exaltation and more referring to all the things around you as friends or neighbors, it seems like. Which is a really cool way to look at things. We'll come back to this in just a moment here on the Jefferson Exchange. Tom Doty's our guest. His new book is Doty Meets Coyote. We'll come back and talk more with him and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange, final segment here. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is longtime Southern Oregon storyteller Thomas Doty. He's a Southern Oregon native. He's got roots in the Shasta and Tequelma tribes, as well as got some Irish and English blood in him as well. His book is called Doty Meets Coyote. It's put out by Blackstone Publishing, part of the Legacy of the First Nations series. We had Agnes Baker Pilgrim or Tao Waihui here a few months ago talking about her book in the same series. If you'd like to join Tom on the Jefferson Exchange, talk about the stories that he carries with him and shares frequently, join us, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. So as a writer, have you added some stories here that didn't previously exist? I mean, you got so many stories that go back so far in time, but there's some of your own stuff in here too, I guess.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of my own stuff. You know, as a storyteller, I really have two parts to my art. And the first part of that is keeping the traditional stories alive with integrity. You know, and while I may use slightly different words than another storyteller to tell that same traditional story, or different gestures and movements when I perform them, the core of the story, the heart of the story, remains intact. What happens in the story, what the story, you know, what the characters do, the various levels of truths of the story, those never change for thousands of years. And I honor those, you know, centuries of storytellers before me who kept them alive. That's half of the work. The other half is to create new native stories from time to time, you know, the sort of toss in that collective pot of folklore, right? Because storytellers before me have always done that. These stories came from somewhere. Somebody made the traditional stories up at some point, right? And they get traded around a lot as well. So that's the two parts. So it gives storytelling an ancient tradition, but it also makes storytelling a living art, a very vibrant art. So those two things together. And so that's what comes out in this book, are both the traditional stories and new native stories.
How rich in experience, I mean, it must be, you do this all the time, but I mean, I'm just thinking in terms of the level of experience of thinking, I'm telling a story with my brain cells and what I've got that people told thousands of years before me.
Right. It's you almost feel like their presence is there, that there are so many storytellers there. They're like in the room when you're telling the story. It's an amazing experience, and connecting to the audience in ways previous storytellers have for thousands of years, inviting people into the story, you know, whether it's with that very first eye contact when you walk out on stage before you even say a word, or just the way that you do your gestures and you pull them in with words, whatever. And then at that point, everybody in the room, including the spirits of the previous storytellers, the audience themselves, you're all part of the same experience of a story that loses time. There's no time. You know, Native American stories really don't, at least around here, really don't have a time frame. They're not linear at all. There's a thing we call myth time, or the Australians call dream time, or the time when the animals and the people could talk to each other, or 10 times 10 years ago, or whatever it happens to be, right? It's that time outside of that Western idea of linear time where the stories exist. And both the old stories and the new stories can all do that.
I'll tell you, Tom Doty's story stays with you for a long time. I still remember the story of the bear who tried to fly.
Oh,
you
I still tell
that story.
Told
it to an audience at the community center, and then...
Yeah.
Yeah, and the hand motions about the bear wanting to be like the birds flying over Mount Shasta.
And he made it. He did it, by golly. Yeah.
But the story of how long it took him to get there is just what makes it so priceless. Here's another call. We have Jim in Grants Pass on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Tom Doty.
Yes, good morning. This story I'm familiar with very much. A lot of the storytellers that traveled with gangs of men during the Depression, when everybody was kind of whatever... Local sheriffs, including old Lloyd Lewis here, he learned to put one of these guys in jail where there might be, you know, some problems, because you had young guys from teens to mid-30s, and there, you know, there was going to be. The gentleman usually had a way of just quietly defusing a whole lot of problems that might have arose. They were usually somebody's uncle. I remember, oh God, it would have been 1950. I would have been, 9 years old. Mother had my tonsils taken out, and I needed somebody, I guess, to sit with me. Well, she had one of these old guys. He was probably in these, what I considered ancient at the time, early 60s, just sit with me. I vividly remember the calming effect of the little whatever we talked about did the job.
Wow, that's amazing. Thanks for that, Jim. Appreciate it. A big thumbs up from you, Tom Doty. We were talking about having such a person in the jail.
Yeah, well, you know, the stories, and one thing I learned early on as a storyteller is, yeah, certainly they entertain us. They pass along winter nights. They teach us about everything Native. I mean, if you really want to learn about Native people, you listen to our stories. That's how we've been learning about ourselves for centuries. But at their very best, when they're doing their best work, stories heal. They go down into that part of us where we feel emotions, sadness to happiness, and everything in between, and they stay with us for a long time. You know, I could tell a little story here that's in the book. It's about a fourth grade girl.
Mm-hmm.
Over on the coast, years ago, I was storytelling residence at a school, and I was going to be there for 3 weeks. And the first day that I walked into the school was a fourth grade girl's first day. And she'd moved all the way from Lakeview, from the desert to the coast, big change of environment, sure, of course. And then the hardest thing for her, as it is for anybody in that situation, especially when you're young, is leaving your friends behind, hoping to make new friends in the school. First day she walks into the school, several children start making fun of her skinny legs, and this makes her feel really bad. She was hoping to make friends. Well, at one point, I'm working in her classroom, and all the students had created their own stories they're gonna tell, and they're rehearsing those stories in groups, so there's all this chaos of gestures and movements and voices and stuff all over the classroom. And right in the middle of all that rehearsal, this little girl comes up, and she says, "Mr. Doty, I want to tell my story to the entire class, and I want to do it right now." I said, "Well, okay." So we gathered everybody together, and this little girl got up in front of her class, which took courage. A lot of kids have been teasing her. And she told this story all about Crane, a big bird with very skinny legs. And in the story, Crane is being teased by the other animals. And Crane is thinking, "This is not good. You should judge people by how they look. There's more to me than skinny legs." Well, in her story was a river, wide river, deep river, swift river. The animals always wanted to see what was on the other side, but they couldn't get across it. This was before, you know, too deep to wade, too swift to swim, before there were bridges, before birds had wings. There was no way to get across the river. Until one day, Crane stretched one of her long, skinny legs across the river, made the very first bridge, so the animals could travel across. But the little girl said, "You better not tease Crane about her skinny legs, you might be halfway across the river at the deepest part, the swiftest part, and Crane might get the shakes like that and dump you off, and that would be the end of you. And that's how she ended her story, like, whoo.
Uh-huh.
It was really quiet in the classroom. You know, the theme, the power, the teaching, the wisdom, the moral, the message, whatever you want to call it, don't judge people came across loud and clear. Then the bell rang, kids went out to recess, and oral tradition happened. So the kids who had heard the story in the classroom went out and told that story on the playground to kids who hadn't heard the story. And just like our native stories have been spreading around for thousands of years, that story spread all through the school. And by the end of that day, most of the kids had quit teasing her about her skinny legs. And by the end of the 3 weeks when I left, she had some really good friends. And that is a healing story.
Oh, that's wonderful. That is wonderful. We have another call here on the line from Nancy in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with the storyteller, Tom Doty.
Hi. Yes, I've known Tom a long time, and I want to say thank you for keeping storytelling alive. And I just finished reading a book that I think you would like. It's called Etta and Otto and Russell and James. And James is a coyote.
Mm-hmm.
The book is by Emma Hooper, a Canadian-British writer, and James is a coyote.
Huh.
Wow.
Sounds really interesting. Thanks for the recommendation.
Thank you, Nancy.
We have an email here from Mike in Medford, who says, although I've traveled the world over, there's nowhere in the world to me that is so beautiful and amazing than Southern Oregon. Since I was a young lad, Roxy Ann Mountain seems to be angry. Every day I take a good look at her, she seems to demand this place be cleaned up and respect restored to those who came before. Are there any stories about our small mountain? That from Mike in Medford. Roxy Ann stories, you have them? And there must be a native name for Roxy Ann.
Aluia.
Mm-hmm.
Aluia, which means kind of knife on edge or knife standing up, kind of. You know, Aluia has been known for the Takamas for a very long time to be a Vision Quest site. I think the knife kind of on edge part refers to kind of a basalt formation up toward the summit that looks a bit like a knife standing up, though I'm not really sure about that. I don't know of any particular old-time myths that include Aluia specifically, like as a character or a place where a story takes place. However, all of the medicine mountains in the mythology of the Takelma are very important, whether it's Mount McLaughlin or whether it's Danmalagal, which is Sexton, or whether it's the mountain up next to Sexton where the big canoe full of animals landed after the Great Flood. You know, these are all medicine mountains, and they're not only places where medicine people go for their vision quests, which tend to be a little more intense than normal people's vision quests, but they are also our watchers of the culture and watchers of the great animal that is the world. So, and I know from Lower Table Rock, there's a little geoglyph, an arrangement of rocks on the ground up there that point directly over to Aluia, to Roxy Ann, and pointing that out as an important place. But that's mostly what I know about Roxy Ann.
You know, you used the term myth just now, and it was a term that I decided not to use because just out of respect. But, the old story is that, my religion plus 300 years is somebody else's myth.
Right.
That sort of thing. So straddling two worlds as you do in a white world and a Native American world, I mean, have you had to tread carefully sometimes in how you refer to what you're talking about?
Yeah, I have. And our modern use in the pop culture of the word myth is very different than how I use it or how Joseph Campbell used it when he spoke so eloquently about myth. You know, a lot of people think of myth as being something, just something untrue, and they'll say, let's dispel the myths of this, right? But in actuality, myth contains some of the more ultimate truths of our existence as human beings, because it's through the myths and the stories that we've learned about who we are and how to get along with each other and all of that. You know, and I think that's becoming more and more, you know, 35 years ago when I started as a storyteller, somebody had asked me what I did, and I say, well, I'm a storyteller, and they look at me kind of funny, like, yeah? And then they'd say something like, well, yeah, my grandpa was a liar too, you know, and they didn't get it. These days, and there were only five of us in the entire state of Oregon were professional storytellers back then. Now there's over 200.
Really?
Yeah, all over Oregon. And now when somebody, when I say that, somebody looks at me and goes, oh, yeah, yeah, I heard such and such telling a story at da-da-da-da-da. So we're having a kind of a renaissance of storytelling around here. And so hopefully the word myth, you know, will kind of come back to taking its right place as something much, much bigger than just simply a lie or a misconception.
I think back to when Agnes Pilgrim, Tal Waihui, was here a few months ago, and she talked about growing up in a near town where there were signs saying no Indians allowed
right. In
the stores. Have we gone fully the other way to respect and reverence for Native traditions?
No, of course not. We have a lot to learn and a lot farther to go, but it is better. It is far better than it was when Grandma Aggie was growing up. A lot more respect for Native cultures, a lot more education. What's being taught in the schools is more accurate than it was even 10 years ago. So we're moving in the right direction, but we have a long way to go to really understanding all of the different Native cultures, including Native American, who are all living among us.
Anne in Grants Pass emails, wanted to know if the story of Old Rock Woman on Mount Sexton was in the book. She says she lives on Mount Sexton and heard you tell the story once and loved it.
It is in the book. It's called Waiting for Rock Old Woman. And it's one of my modern Doty and Coyote stories, but it also includes within the narrative a lot of the traditional story about Rock Old Woman. Dan Mulligall is her Takelma name. So, yeah, it's in there.
Like any good storyteller, you notice small details. And you were held captive by a picture, it sounds like, in your childhood. Tell us about the picture of the redwoods in your grandparents' house.
Oh, that picture, yes. There was a picture in my grandparents' house above the telephone. That was a picture of the redwoods, a very old picture of the redwoods with a frame of seashells around it, right? It was kind of popular at the time, I think. And I was just fascinated by that picture. It showed a road, you know, covered with redwood needles and stuff along the edge, you know, going off to somewhere really special. And I thought, man, that's the road to one of those magical places where the stories come from. And in my youth there, I thought, you know, there's a reason they put it above the telephone. You know, maybe the telephone is the way. Maybe I can call up. So I started making these calls, long-distance calls. And of course, that didn't work out with my grandparents very well. But eventually, that drew me into a story, and that story is in the book as well, Truths of Trees, all about the redwoods.
That's some great stuff in Doty Meets Coyote. I understand you're going to be at Bloomsbury Books, is that right, Monday?
Monday night at 7 o'clock, yes.
Okay, Tom Doty is the author of Doty Meets Coyote, a collection of stories ancient and contemporary. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
You bet. My pleasure.